You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This panel is called, Online Privacy on Trial. Has Congress given industry self-regulation long enough? I'm going to very briefly introduce our panelists, and then we are going to go through some stages of the Internet debate to try to get us ready to understand what's likely to happen this year and next year in Congress and in Washington. My name is Peter Swire. I'm currently a law professor at The Ohio State University. Under President Clinton, I served as chief counselor for privacy in the U.S. Office of Management and Budget, and I also worked in the Obama administration until last summer under Larry Summers, the National Economic Council. To my left is Declan McCullough, who has been a reporter in the Internet space, very widely read these days on CNET, founded Polytech, et cetera, and has really watched this issue through its different chapters. To his left is Justin Brookman, who is the director of the Project on Consumer Privacy at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And prior to that, Justin was very involved in the state of New York, where the Attorney General's office has been a leader in taking actions, enforcement actions, on various privacy violations. To his left is Stu Ingus, who's a partner at the law firm Venable. Stu also has been a leader in self-regulatory efforts recently on the online behavioral advertising space. We're sorry to say that today Jody Bernstein was not feeling well. Jody, as many of you know, was a central person in the 1990s in the Federal Trade Commission when she was director of the Office of Consumer Protection on privacy. She's also just one of the most delightful people to have on a panel in Washington, so I'm sorry to say we don't have Jody with us today. She sends her regrets. I think the reason the room's full here today and the reason the panel is happening is that privacy, once again, is a hot topic. It's on the front pages of the newspaper. Many of you might have read part of the Wall Street Journal series about new tracking devices that happen online. The Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Commerce both have reports out for comment. Comments are due by the end of January. So people are busy around town trying to figure out what to say about privacy for that reason. Last year, Stu was involved in a big self-regulatory announcement by the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau. So we're seeing self-regulatory efforts to come up with standards for leading companies on the Internet. And the last Congress had more action on privacy legislation, I think it's fair to say, than any of the several Congresses before then. So this panel is going to focus, we've been asked to focus, on one key issue that's relevant to the role of Congress in the area of online privacy. What should be in legislation, if anything, and what should be done by market forces or by industry self-regulation on the other? When I say self-regulation, the law professor in me wants me to point out that self-regulation in the United States means something slightly specific. It means that the industry is very involved in defining what their promises are. Once they make those promises, however, they get held to them. So the Federal Trade Commission can bring enforcement actions because they violated their promises, and all 50 state, the attorneys general, can bring enforcement actions if a company violates its promises. So self-regulation really comes to coming up with the standards for what you're going to do with personal information. It's not saying that industry gets to do whatever it wants under all circumstances. So now I'm going to turn to the first piece of our discussion, which is a brief background of privacy into the 1990s. This is where Jody was going to come and give delightful commentary, talk about how she would get industry to open their kimonos, which is one of Jody's trademark figures of speech, which I can't say as well as she does, and so on. Here's a question first. How many people in the audience, show of hands, were working on privacy during the 1990s battles on privacy? So we see some less than a third of the room. And so for most of you, the majority of you, and the folks on C-SPAN watching, I guess, there's some history here that maybe can make us realize that in some ways we're seeing patterns that are very similar to the late 1990s. And here's what I mean by that. In the 1990s, the Internet was taking off. There was no commercial activity on the Internet until 1993. But by the end of the 1990s, the Internet bubble had happened. These companies were taking off. Data was going everywhere. And we didn't know the rules. A second fact in the 1990s was the European Union had what they call the Data Protection Directive, which said that in Europe, for all the member states, there are strict privacy rules about how companies use data. And they were threatening to cut off data flows to the United States if we didn't come up with some good regime in the United States. We have similar discussions with the EU today. What stepped into that, the legal innovation that stepped into that, was the Federal Trade Commission saying, wait a second, we have a general law called Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, and that prohibits unfair or deceptive trade practices. And this is where Jody Bernstein, Chairman Bob Petofsky, and others at the FTC realized that if a company had a privacy policy and it broke its policy, that could be deceptive. And suddenly federal regime, federal law, had a role here without a new statute from Congress. In the administration, meanwhile, there was support for some kinds of privacy legislation, but not others. During that period, HIPAA, the medical privacy rules, happened. Gramm-Leach-Bliley, the financial privacy rules, happened. And in something that might be a preview of Congress this year, maybe, maybe not, there was a focus on children's privacy on the Internet called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA. And so the administration's position was, we're going to be a little more cautious on some of this in the FTC, but for the most sensitive sorts of things, legislation's appropriate. In the face of this political interest, Republican Congress in those days, Democratic president, just in case that's relevant, in the face of this, industry went on a period of talking about self-regulation. Maybe industry can get its act together, come up with standards, have privacy policies happen. And industry actually moved quite quickly during this period. In 1997, the Federal Trade Commission did a survey. Only 12% of the leading Internet sites had any privacy policy at all. Congress, the FTC, the administration said, you all have to do better. In 1999, 88% of all commercial websites surveyed had privacy policies. A lot of movement in a short time in a self-regulatory world where the companies were putting up their privacy policy. Now, we'll see that some of that activity tailed off after 2000, and that's one of the concerns about self-regulation. But as a background in that area, there was a lot of attention for Internet Web, for Web 1.0, for the new Internet, what the rules are going to be. I think today, in some ways, we're trying to figure out Internet 2.0, social networking and the rest. And there was self-regulation as a response, but legislation sitting there as a possibility. Let me stop there and see if Declan or Stu, who lived through this period, have anything on the background to help set us up.
Sure, I'll jump in on the setup there. I think Peter defined it right, and defined in particular, I think, the late 90s, probably starting in 96 or 97, is when the commercial Internet and websites were proliferating everywhere and the first privacy notices became obvious and available. And there were several self-regulatory regimes set up at the time. One was the Direct Marketing Association, actually, for many years had an offline information promises to consumers and the ability to opt out or exercise choice not to have information shared to third parties. There was a big push to move that online, and so there was a thing called the DMA's privacy promise, where it went out and got all of its members, some 4,000, to agree to honor this commitment in the online environment. In addition, and Peter referenced it, a group known as the Online Privacy Alliance surfaced back then in order to help with the push that showed the metrics that Peter described to get privacy policies widely adopted. And I think you saw wide adoption coming out of that initiative in two different ways. One was the mere number of sites that included privacy policies and the practices tied to the principles that were adopted in the Online Privacy Alliance. The other was the percentage of Internet traffic, where particularly back then, and I think less so now, there were still really a handful of companies that generated almost all of the Internet traffic. That's true now, but for different reasons. At the time, it was the publisher sites or the content that was doing it, and you had, you know, well into the 90s percentile of coverage of where the practices were that consumers mattered. Peter, I don't know if you wanted me to jump in at legislative stuff now.
We will in just a second. Declan, any historical?
Sure. Well, let's think of recent history. I mean, I think it's fair to say that there's a revival of interest recently, and this is one reason why we're all here today. I write about this for CNET and occasionally for CBS News' website, CBS owns CNET. And from my perspective, I've been following technology since that first technology initiative of the Clinton administration, the Clipper chip. We've seen this series of privacy leaks, and I'm not even talking about WikiLeaks, that has led to this interest. As AT&T's website leaked the email addresses of over 100,000 iPad owners. Charges were filed today against the people involved in taking advantage of that leak. There was a browser extension that was discovered to leak your web history to Amazon.com if you didn't configure it properly. Google Buzz initially, in its initial incarnation, could leak your correspondence identities. There was a Google Street View Wi-Fi data flap that led to an FTC investigation, but not a fine. There was the leak of Gawker's user database, which was improperly secured. There was the discovery that Facebook leaked some user data to advertisers, and that was the exchange of letters with Ed Markey and Joe Barton. And I think a lot of this interest in privacy, Facebook can take the credit or the blame for that. There was the F8 Developer Conference last spring, and CEO Mark Zuckerberg unveiled what is probably fair to say a sweeping set of changes to the way that Facebook interacts with third parties. Developers love this, but privacy advocates became concerned. A week or so later, Chuck Schumer tried to prompt, as a direct result of this, the FTC to regulate social networking sites, or at the very least probe deeply into this. Later, Facebook kept on going. It overhauled groups, it redesigned profiles, added a slicker messaging service, announced Facebook Places, the geolocation system. There was, of course, the social network. I'm not sure if that hurt or helped Facebook. Zuckerberg keeps saying that the movie isn't accurate, and maybe it is, but he also boasts about taking the entire company to see it. We did see some privacy proposals from Congress. There was the one that, from Rick Boucher, who lost his bid for re-election, probably not as a consequence, but nobody liked his. Nobody liked Bobby Rush's proposal either, at least not many folks. And yet, after over a decade of discussing this, I mean, this has been discussed since the 1990s, the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing on online privacy last July, and they couldn't even begin to narrow the discussion. I mean, their members were worried about Amazon keeping records of what customers purchased, which is, I think, a really good thing as an Amazon customer, unsubscribing from spam, spammers list, peer-to-peer software vulnerabilities, Nebuad cancer patients, email, Facebook commercially scanning, what agency should be in charge, credit like card disclosure statements. It's all over the map. If this is a situation that Congress is facing, and I think it is, I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of there's going to be a lot of interest and a lot of discussion, but I don't see the Senate successfully voting on this this year.
Okay, so we now know. I mean, that's a glimpse of some of what's been happening, but boy, a lot's been happening on privacy leaks. Stu, could you help us? You lived through the legislative period, in the late 90s into the early part of the previous decade. Help give us a sense of the legislative landscape then, why it seemed like there was serious momentum, and how does that lead us into today?
Sure. I think what was true then and is probably more true than ever today is, we obviously are living in the information age, and why shouldn't we be debating information policy and the complexity of how information's flowed? And, as Declan went through his litany of stuff being all over the map, you can see a map, there's an issue here and an issue there. I think that's right, and I think it's reflective of the fact that information and the Internet and all of these practices are pervasive in every component of our life, and it raises simple questions about about how you apply stuff before the Internet was pervasive in every angle of our life into the current framework and structure. And I think all of that started at the time of the commercial Internet, and immediately there were legislative responses. There was a response. The first, I think, real proposal that got a lot of traction at the time was a proposal of Senator Kerry and Senator McCain. And some of the concepts are the same concepts, many actually, that we're discussing today, albeit we've gotten a lot more sophisticated in how we discuss them and the types of practices practices that they'd apply to. And that bill, actually, there was a big debate. Everything at the time was PII. How do you collect? I mentioned the DMA promise, privacy promise, but how do you collect? What do you do with name and address information you collect online? How is it used? And so, you know, the choices were all about personally identifiable information. And in that bill, the initial inclination was what the industry standard had been for years and continues to be, with for marketing at least, with the default as an opt-out. There were questions about preemption, debates about access to information, and a lot of the framework was based on notice. Give consumers notice about what you'll do with their data and choice with respect to those uses to third parties. And that was a fairly high-level, almost philosophical view of legislation. What followed was a much more detailed legislative proposal, also in the Senate, by then chairman of the committee, Senator Hollings. And that proposal really, I think, started with somewhat where what had been left off with an opt-out proposal, but quickly in the legislative process and through committee switched, as I recall, to an opt-in, where the information flows were going to be restrictive. And that, I think, actually got fairly close to getting consensus in the Senate, at least on a relative basis, than any of the proposals so far. And I would argue probably the Internet bubble implosion and following up with September 11th is probably what took a lot of wind out of the sails of those proposals. And that proposal also had a private cause of action in it. And there was a lot of debate at the time about whether these things were good and bad. What followed, and we had mentioned the self-regulatory efforts, all of this, the self-regulation and what Peter described, were already going on at the same time. Jody wasn't here, so I knowing that this morning, I pulled this up because I remember this release, which some people forget, you know, in the spirit of what's old is new again. This is a press release from May 22nd, 2000, in the middle of, I think, the era we're talking about. And it says, FTC recommends congressional action to protect consumer privacy online. And at the time, the FTC put out a two-part study and indicated that self-regulation, while good and the right standards for the people adopting it, wasn't broad enough. There were players that wouldn't cover everybody. How was it enforceable? A lot of the same arguments and even maybe some of the same headlines you're seeing now. We then saw 10 years, really, I think, of a shift of position, starting with the Stearns bill and probably a change in leadership in the House of Representatives to a Republican Party, where you had everything back to an opt-out bill. You had things tied to safe harbors and deference to self-regulatory frameworks. But kind of the significance of the proposals and the attention they were getting and their likelihood of success, I think, really deflated from then until really the last Congress. So maybe it's probably a good point to hand it back to Peter.
Okay. Well, so and one thing to note here is there's been a history of activity from both Democratic and Republican sides. So a McCain-Kerry bill originally, Chairman Stearns had a bill where he was proposing legislation, and there were pretty serious hearings and consideration in committee as a Republican bill. Senator Hollings is a Democrat. And for people who haven't been around privacy for a while, it might be a little unclear, maybe not. So within the Democratic side, I think there's been often a concern that consumers are not being treated well. There ought to be sort of a consumer protection side to the Internet, on out towards a stronger positions further out of sort of towards the ACLU or something about just keep that data away as a matter of liberty. But on a conservative side, privacy, not having them look at your home or look at your personal life or it's your property, has also been a theme. I think Congressman Joe Barton is somebody who's voiced that as a conservative Republican for Texas who supported privacy legislation over time. So it would not be appropriate to have some assumptions that you know what the answers are politically based on political party. Justin, could you help bring us up to date? We've heard about some of the legislation from the previous round of activity. What do you feel like has gotten legislative activity going again, and could you describe a little bit about what's happening in the current scene?
Sure. So definitely after the 2000, we got to the brink of privacy law, then dot-com bubble, 9/11 happened, definitely the floor fell off on interest in doing anything. So think of it, the nadir is kind of 2004. The second half of the Bush administration, you start to see people getting interested in these issues again. So the FTC started to be pretty active in the area of spyware, which is something that I worked a lot on at the AG's office. It kind of really found its voice for consumer protection online with some of its spyware cases. Getting into 2007, then Commissioner, then now Chairman John Leibowitz continues to be really vocal on a lot of these issues. FTC starts to hold discussions around the issues of online behavioral advertising. Something that something needs to be done about, and so they eventually released their guidelines on OBA. Not saying what you have to do. So sometimes the FTC will release a report saying, if you don't do this, we're going to deem it to be deceptive. That's what they did with the blogging guidelines for endorsements. They didn't do that. They said, here are some ideas about how to make online behavioral advertising more transparent. Around that time, some of the self-regulatory groups like IAB and NAI, who had been relatively dormant for several years without a legislative push, started to get active again in some of these issues. And then in 2009, Rick Boucher said that he's going to introduce privacy legislation. So those of y'all who were here last year, remember, we were all wondering when's the voucher bill going to come out. It actually didn't come out until several months later in around April. And I think, Declan may be overstating a little bit about the negative reaction to it, but a lot of people did have a lot of questions about it. And to be clear, it was just released in the draft. Both Representatives Boucher and Stern say this is a really important issue. We're not introducing this bill. We want to get feedback from everybody about what this sort of legislation should look like. And I think the main takeaway from both the privacy groups and the pro-industry groups was that it was very, very prescriptive. It was very, very narrow. It kind of defined all privacy issues in the context of online behavioral advertising. So if you do basically what Google does, which is offer access to profiles and get rid of data after 18 months, then you're in relatively good shape under the bill. But then other industries were like, we're data brokers. We need information for longer than that. This doesn't really map very well to what we do. People in the offline space kind of the same reaction. So a few months later, Representative Rush released his bill, and I would definitely disagree with Declan about this bill. I think there was actually a fair amount of positive things said about it. I mean, our organization certainly thought it was 90-95% of what we'd like to see in a privacy bill. You did see some companies come out and say endorse the bill effectively. Microsoft, Intel, eBay kind of came out and said this is a kind of a good, smart way to go about privacy legislation. So instead of being very prescriptive with saying what exactly you need to do to treat data, and opposed to just announcing very high-level, top-line principles about protect privacy and then figure out what it means later, which is effectively what the Data Protection Directive did, and then 15 years later, we still don't know exactly what it means. They did build into the bill this idea of safe harbors. So if you're an industry, you're online behavioral advertising, you go into a room, you suggest ideas about how you're going to protect privacy, but it's not just self-regulation because at the end of the day, the FTC needs to approve that. And so there's a multi-stakeholder framework in place for industry and civil society and government to kind of come up with industry-specific rules that are flexible over time. So we thought that was a really strong idea for a bill. Primarily in the opt-out mode. By and large, opt-in, you're not really seeing it in a lot of legislative proposals these days. There's one hearing on that in July, a second hearing in December with the idea of adding into that bill do not track. And so do not track has been a huge thing here in town. The idea that you're going to do an opt-out framework for privacy, you have to have some sort of global opt-out. So I don't need to go out and find every company who might be tracking it. I don't need to go find BlueKai or Rubicon Project or anyone offline, the data aggregator. There need to be universal global solutions to opting out. That hearing was in December, and then Congress ended. So now we're kind of starting all over again. The thing that everyone's waiting for this year is the Kerry bill. Senator Kerry last year announced that he's going to be putting forward legislation on this issue. Cliff Stearns has said again he wants to put forward legislation on this issue. Now the House has changed over, so it sounds like it's continued to be an area there. obviously, the wild card is always kids' privacy. You hear a lot of representatives talk about maybe doing do not track just for kids. Our perspective is there's not a lot of teen laws we like to see that shouldn't apply to adults as well. It seems kind of depressing to have rights about, don't track me online, these companies, and all of a sudden at 18 you lose those rights. So you have to be tracked by companies you don't know who they are. So that's the framework for where we are right now, and we'll see where we end up this Congress.
Okay, Declan, you had some statistics that you found.
I do. I'll respond to you on Boucher briefly. I mean, I know that CET loved Boucher. I'm looking at Jerry Berman's Internet Loses Strong Congressional Advocate with Defeat of Rick Boucher.
Lots of people said that.
You're right, but also I'm looking at the statements that came out when Boucher actually announced his bill, and it was, this bill is not the answer, Consumer Action said. We're very disappointed with his legislation, Consumer Federation said. And Adam Theorite quoted at the time, who was sitting in the third row, saying, from the other side, more the free market camp, this bill is not the answer. But I think you might be right on Rush. Maybe I overstated that a bit. But the stats that Peter mentioned, I did a search before coming over here this morning through a news database going back to 1992 for the term Congress and privacy law within 100 privacy law. And it's interesting, just to count the frequency of news articles on the topic of privacy law and Congress. Starting in 1992, it was just 30 articles per year. The high water mark was the year 2000 at 372 articles per year. And it's actually fallen since. With the low water mark being in 2009, and it's come back up, going back up last year. And if you do a broader search, Congress, privacy, and internet, web, etc., you see that the high water mark was 2006 for the broader term, and it's actually been falling. It fell for 2009 and started going up again in 2010. This is just media coverage. It may or may not be reflective of what Congress is doing, but you see the high water mark is not now. It was a few years ago with both searches, but we're back on the upswing, so maybe we'll see that high water mark coming again.
What I'm inclined to do is just make a couple comments on this. I don't know if Stu, do you have anything on what we've said on the legislation, or should we wait for a minute till we get to the legislation versus self-regulation?
Okay.
So here's a couple of thoughts about why media might be going up and why we're all in the room here. One is, you've heard the term Web 2.0, which has something to do with interactive media, user-generated content, social media. We don't know what the right rules are for that. We can't go back to de Tocqueville and know what he would have done with social media. I mean, there's a lot of new stuff. And the way, to me, having lived through the 1990s so vividly, this feels similar because in 97, 98, we didn't sort of know what the right way to think about this was. And I would put to you that when it comes to some of the Facebook privacy issues, we haven't settled down as a society and sort of figured out what we think's the right answer and not the right answer on various things. So that's a time for lots of discussion. A second thing that's happening right now is, as the Wall Street Journal series sort of highlighted, is that behavioral advertising seems to have hit a point where it's being more effective at financially getting the right people to be interested in the right things, but it's also at the same time perhaps being granular or specific or better at tracking you in various ways. So the privacy risk and the financial gain seem to be higher right about now. And those are reasons in this period that we're in for there to be some hubbub about just what's the right thing to do. I'm going to make two comments about the legislative situation we've had, and then we're going to get into legislation versus self-regulation. The first is the importance of kids' privacy. 1999, Congress was sure they didn't want to regulate about the Internet. And there were stories about kids being advertised to on the Internet, asking what kind of car mom drives and how many bedrooms, that cartoon characters asking kids this stuff. And whatever the reality of these stories was, it got Congress's attention. They didn't want kids being asked this stuff. And unanimously, a law was passed in a very short time. So anytime it's kids, as we heard in some of the morning's panels, bets are off about how social conservatives, for instance, might feel about free market. Social conservatives tend to be very protective of the family. It's a different framework, and legislation becomes at least thinkable. With that, I'm going to go to the sort of legislation versus self-regulation discussion, sort of debate, and then we'll turn to audience questions. I'm going to start with some points that some of the big online companies have emphasized why legislation may make sense at this point. Justin's going to expand that case, and then I think Stu and Declan are going to have a plethora of reasons why maybe these aren't great reasons to have legislation. So if you're thinking of a case for Congress acting and legislating about online privacy or privacy, one thing that may be relevant, that's certainly relevant to major internet companies, is the international situation. So Europe is revising its directive. They're trying to come up with a new set of stricter practices. And they're asking, gee whiz, United States, you don't even have any laws in place. Why should we trust you at all? Maybe we're going to start telling all these American-based multinationals they can't operate in our countries, or they're going to have to change their architecture. So how do you have that international debate? Number two is that there's a variety of state laws that have come in. California, for instance, other states have stepped in. And so industry has some concern that they're going to get stuck with 50 different state rules, harder to engineer. If we have a uniform national way to do it, that has some major advantages. A third point that some of the main companies make is the big players are already regulated. Some of them have FTC consent decrees, but a lot of them have very clear privacy policies, and if they screw up, Declan or somebody's going to write about them. And so when we have this kind of system in place, not for the bad actors who are smaller, but only for the biggest companies, that might not be a reason to think self-regulation by itself is enough. Justin, you want to expand on that, some reasons to consider privacy legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd just say, I mean, kind of maybe a facile argument, but I guess it's really that just self-regulation hasn't worked. You look at the eight fair information practice principles that consumer advocates ask for in a framework, in a regime. You think like purpose specification. Do companies really tell you why they're taking your data? And the answer is no. I mean, they have these long privacy policies. If privacy policy was a great success out of self-regulation before, I mean, I think we all recognize we need to go farther than that. And this is like the main theme of the FTC report that came out in December, that privacy policies aren't really meaningful to consumers. They're arguably on the margins meaningful to me, whose job it is to read these things. But even when I read them, I still don't know what companies are doing. I mean, we had a project where we actually went through 100 of the top privacy policies and tried to figure out what they meant. And they by and large just reserve huge amounts of rights. And so they're written by lawyers whose job it is not to be sued. And they say, we reserve the right to share information about you with our third-party marketing partners. So effectively, at the end of the day, these policies are, if not necessarily meaningless, they're not really privacy protective. So if you look at the one of the fair information practices we kind of have today is security. Now, there's actually a pretty good security framework out there, and the reason is because there are laws behind it. First, with state data breach notification laws, that if you actually lose someone's data, it becomes very expensive for you to have to tell the people around the world about it. And second of all, the FTC has interpreted their authority to just say, if you don't put good security in place, then we're going to deem that to be an unfair practice under the law. Companies responded to that, and that we actually have pretty good security procedures in place now. As far as self-regulation on the online behavioral advertising side, where there was a lot of interest in doing this back in 2000, the network advertising initiative formed and said, we're going to take care of this. We're going to fix a lot of these problems. Once the regulatory interest went away, it became very hard to get companies to agree to self-regulate and to do this. And I worry that if we don't go down that road again, if something bad happens, if this moment passes, if we don't pass legislation, then the self-regulatory efforts are going to fade away. Secondly, even if self-regulation works in online behavioral advertising, and Stu's going to convince me in a second that they absolutely are going to, even if it works perfectly, I mean, online behavioral advertising is just one relatively narrow area on privacy. You haven't seen, and the Commerce Report says the Digital Advertising Alliance is doing a good job in trying to work through some of these issues, but what about cloud computing? It doesn't really address that. What about social networking? I mean, Facebook has tremendous amounts of access to my data, and what the limitations on what they can do with that, what they need to tell me about it, or what they impose on themselves. In the mobile space, I mean, there's no limitations on what these companies can do and track you. And Jules, who just came in, tweeted this morning that one of the leading apps was written by a 14-year-old. And who wrote that privacy policy? Was it his mom? There's no real.
His lawyer, I hope.
Well, hopefully, mom's a lawyer. But these apps are being developed by people in their garage without a lot of access to great legal advice. And one last thing at this point. If you went to the Senate Commerce hearing last year, all the senators came in and told a story that, imagine you're at a mall and there's someone behind you watching what you do and tracking what you do all over the mall, and then later sending ads to you based on that. There actually is that industry developing. There is very good digital signage and facial recognition and identification about you, and there's no real parallel self-regulatory effort around that. So I think, you know, we
and that, I mean, maybe that's a good jumping in point for me on defense, so to speak. But, you know, some of the rhetoric around that specific issue, and then I will convince all of you why self-regulation is so effective. Most of you know it by looking at some of my friends in the audience. But, you know, the notion that was made in some of those hearings, and there have been press articles and quotes by other government officials who I have great respect for, but the notion that following a consumer around anonymously online to deliver an ad that they might be a sports enthusiast or a travel enthusiast for a discount that may be relevant, the notion of the contrast, which I think is what is inferred, maybe Justin didn't quite say it, but at least at its worst rhetoric, that that's equivalent to somebody, a pedophiliac, stalking a 12-year-old in a mall, and all of that follows is just completely absurd. You know, maybe that's not even as strong of a word. I mean, they're two very, very different things. And so I think, and I will agree with Justin on this, I think that kind of traditional advertising and marketing probably is an issue that needs to be considered distinctly from some of the other privacy issues, in particular some of the government surveillance type issues that Peter referenced earlier. I represent a lot of clients on the Hill before on these issues, and I often, the first thing I walk in and say, because I'm representing the advertising and marketing interests, is if you just put in a nice advertising or marketing carve-out, you know, it'd be a lot easier to pass your law, because that's really the primary reason that businesses want to use information. And it's pro-consumer. Right? Justin used the term, the rhetoric, you know, pro-industry, but it's really industry, what industry is for, but it's pro-consumer. The use of all that data is pro-consumer. It's less spam. It's more relevant. It's discounts. It's all of the efficient content online. So tied to that, I'll talk a bit briefly about the self-regulatory framework. It's been referenced as the Digital Advertising Alliance. That's the legal name. A coalition was brought together of the leading trade associations, the DMA, the IAB, the NAI, the Association of National Advertisers, ANA, the 4As, and I could go on and on with the alphabet soup, and all of the major companies in the space and others, to develop a code to respond, I think, to some of the criticisms of the FTC, which I think were fair criticisms, not so much that the business community hadn't kept up, but that the world had evolved, that there needed to be stronger enforcement. I think that's always a fair criticism of self-regulation, there needed to be more notice to consumers of some of these non-identifiable, I mentioned personally identifiable information, which was the big genesis of the debate in the late 90s, but non-identifiable clickstream about web surfing behaviors, transparency outside of the privacy notice in a way that consumers would understand this is happening, and we wound up agreeing, there's an icon I think you see on all of your mugs, Jules was referenced earlier, but his group, the Future of Privacy Forum, did some great market research and intelligence behind what consumers would react to on icons, and so you get that transparency. The outside of the notice. And then the biggest issue, though, I think, is what's been referenced several times, is that it's no longer eight companies that are engaged in these types of practices. You really are talking about every company in many aspects of society. And to me, the barometer, and maybe I'll stop to make sure others get their points in, but the barometer of whether self-regulation has been effective is whether there continues to be the level of innovation that exists in society. And I got to tell you, we have never seen, you all know this, but I this is a message I love to deliver. I mean, we are living through the greatest innovation and technology revolution, which has been going on now for 10 years plus, and it's going to continue. It's just getting started. And had we put in some of the types of proposals or restrictions that have been proposed all along the way, all with good thinking, I would argue that many of the Facebooks and the Googles and all of those great companies and products and services that adapt and all of that wouldn't exist. And so you contrast that on a policy basis to what are the shortfalls, what are the concerns, and what are, and where can we do more? There hasn't been a lot of real empirical harm. I think harm may not be the pure right standard, but consumers being aware and transparency, there's continued improvement, and then choices. And so the type of choice being called for and do not track, I think, you know, those of us in the, that represent the business community don't particularly like the name, don't think that it's something the government should be mandating, because people still on this day trust their government, and if the government's mandating or encouraging it, it makes it seem as if these practices are bad, which they're not. And so the business community tied to this proposal has offered up a uniform choice. It's just being deployed now. You can go find it at aboutads.info, but that will give the one type of choice. And so I think when you talk about some of the substance that Justin referred to and that I'm laying out here, I think there's actually a lot of agreement. The question, and maybe even, and one other point I'll make just on law is, those we represent, the DMA and some of the others, have never been opposed. In fact, we supported the Children's Online Privacy Act, have not been opposed to law per se. It's laws that would interfere with the legitimate practices as agreed upon and set forth in self-regulation. So there could be legislative frameworks that would allow for the preservation of those ongoing practices.
Let me try to get Declan in here. I'm going to try to phrase this. The case for legislation in a way, and then I have a feeling you'll be skeptical. So to the extent people understand when they go online that they have basic rights, that they shouldn't be tracked or they should have some control over their own lives, and to the extent we saw in 2001 that there was a lot of focus on privacy, then it dropped away and it seems like the self-regulation withered, stopped being very effective. Why shouldn't we have basic charters of laws in here instead of letting the ebbs and flows happen the way it seems like we've seen historically?
You're right. The high water mark in terms of the number of times privacy law was mentioned in the press, which is a crude approximation, but that was in 2000, maybe 2001 as well, and it's dropped by almost 50% as of last year. But I'd quibble with your question.
How does that match the reduction in media outlets, by the way?
This is a topic for a separate conference. But I would like to quibble with my law professor friend. That's you, Peter.
Thanks.
On one point, that's
which is a go ahead.
There's on legislation versus self-regulation. I mean, we already are operating under this constellation of regulation today. Even the absence of any overarching federal law, we have fraud laws, we have antitrust laws, we have contract law, we have class action laws, we have state privacy torts in every state. We have state attorneys general. I mean, everyone knows what New York has been up to. We have private lawsuits that you as a consumer can file in states like California. Hey, know any companies with offices there that might be vulnerable to them if they misbehave? And so, I mean, maybe this. I'm wearing my columnist hat. I have to apologize, but that's why you asked me this. But maybe this existing as it is today regulatory environment doesn't reach the market outcome that advocacy groups would like. But it doesn't mean that it amounts to a market failure. I have a 15-month-old son, and I'd like to get him metal matchboxes of the sort that I had when I was growing up. But you only can get plastic ones today for probably a fraction of the price. Is that a market failure? It's not the outcome I'd like, but I just live with it. And when we hear a lot about market failures without any proof that they actually exist, it's more hand-waving. But I'd also like to hear about government failures and the negative unintended consequences that can't really be anticipated. And we hear about the benefits of privacy legislation, but not the harm. I'd like to see a really rigorous economic analysis of this. I mean, this is a large sector of the economy nowadays. It includes not just sites that you think of, the Facebooks and Twitters. It also includes sites like news organizations that are encouraging people, our readers, our viewers, to stop by and set up accounts and interact and share stories, set up profiles. And one last point. We've been talking a lot about regulating companies, but let's not forget in the online world about regulating the government. There's the Digital Due Process Coalition with AOL, Amazon, AT&T, Google, Microsoft, Salesforce, Salesforce.com CDT as well. And it's been around about half a year, and so far we haven't seen legislation introduced yet. It might be worth asking the panelists or the audience if they think that's actually going to happen or this effort is just going to go away.
I'm going to want Justin to respond to Declan, but let me just take the government thing for a minute, then we'll come back to legislation. So for people who haven't lived through the privacy debates, so far we've been talking about commercial privacy, the data that companies hold. There's a really big other set of debates around when the government gets data. Some of you have heard of the Patriot Act, for instance. But beyond that, there's all sorts of rules about how the government can get access to the corporate databases. And so a lot of the companies that have been most involved in the Internet have said those rules right now are not clear enough and in some cases aren't strict enough. And that's the Digital Due Process Coalition, who want to amend laws like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And so there's a sort of companies and civil liberties coalition saying we should have laws. The laws should make it clear that government shouldn't be browsing around in all this advertising data and all of this Google data and all this whatever else data.
Well, it's also like if you're a police or a prosecutor and you want to, say, read my physical diary, you need a search warrant. But if that diary is uploaded to Google Docs or up on Yahoo Mail, you can get it without a search warrant. And if you want to track me in real time right now, you don't need a search warrant because a cell phone is essentially a tracking device. So that's the push. The courts are already moving in that direction. The idea, I guess, is to prod Congress into speeding that up.
And it fits into the commercial debate because if you think that data is being collected by companies, maybe with all sorts of consent for good advertising and marketing reasons, but it's going to end up in the government, sometimes people's intuitions shift about whether that collection of data is quite as good because they don't like the government having that data quite as much. Justin, I want to come back. Declan made various points about why he prefers self-regulation to legislation. Here. There's no particular market failure. Stu said maybe there's not really harm to consumers. Why should we pass legislation if there's no market failure and no harm?
Well, I think there has been a market failure. So first, I guess I push back on the argument from both of you about, primarily from Stu, about whether there should be exception for marketing in any particular law. I think the story the senator was talking about when someone's kind of watching you go from place to place wasn't, I don't think, meant to suggest that the marketing is about pedophilia. I think that's somewhat of a straw man argument. But I think it's just that people don't like the idea of someone over their shoulders following them around, watching everything they do. So no, it's not the worst thing in the world. No, people aren't going to die because of it. Nevertheless, people don't like it. I mean, when you ask people in polls, poll after poll after poll after poll, describing relatively basic behavioral advertising techniques.
Sure. You could apply that poll. There's lots of things, and this goes back to Declan's point about cars. There's lots of things that people don't like. You know, we've gone out in response to some of the surveys about consumers don't like to be followed. I actually even dispute that consumers are followed in the same way because it's anonymous and it's not full cloth and there's a lot of protections. But we say, do you like the free content? Do you like the Internet? Do you like all the diversity? And we get the same. We don't get 92%. We get 100% like it. And that's where the challenge of the policy balance comes.
So make that value proposition to consumers, right? I mean, like, and your project is going a long way towards doing that. Let consumers make informed choice about how their data is being used. Right now, the companies who are taking and trading and using data are effectively free riders because there's no way for me to figure out how my data is being spread about out there. If I wanted to pick and choose among like the New York Times or the Washington Post saying which one's more privacy protective, I actually cannot figure that out right now. They have privacy policies, but they're not structured in any way since I can actually pick and choose which ones are privacy protective. So I think we want to end up in a place, advertisers have this icon in there. You can use it to actually find out how your information is being used. I think
that's right. We want, and I think even in our back and forth here, you know, privacy is such a personal issue. You know, some people care quite a bit about any collection of information about them, anonymous or not. And I think that's your reference. And some, you know, don't care at all or like the benefits. And I think the notion is to build in more transparency so people can make those choices.
Yeah, and I very much agree with that. And as far as like the fact that there are laws out there, I mean, like I was at the New York Attorney General's office. We were looking to do privacy privacy cases, but the only privacy cases you can bring under the current framework are enforcing notice and choice, which are, we have a notice, which you, if you find, you will find that unless we make it just a stupid error, you cannot bring a case against you. I mean, the notice is we reserve the right to do what we want. The choice is you're presumed to have acknowledged that. That's what I can enforce. So that's why you didn't see a lot of privacy cases, right? I mean, we brought a couple spyware cases. We brought some where the companies made some stupid, poor decisions. You are seeing the rejuvenated plaintiff bar, actually from a former New York AG involved in that. But they actually haven't litigated any of those cases yet. I'm not entirely sure they would win. So I mean, where we want to end up as privacy advocates, I recognize that the Internet has been fantastic. We don't want a very...
Can you concede that?
I concede that. I don't want...
If Center for Democracy and Technology doesn't...
I don't think they consider
their client to be the...
We're not looking for the European model of very strong worded principles and no one knows what they mean.
We
endorse the framework that's been put out there by Commerce. That was in the Rush bill that we hope is going to be in the Kerry bill. That industry should have a role and come to the table and put forward basic, flexible, intelligent, pro-innovative rules, right, that they don't have right now. And we think it needs to be backed up in law, because otherwise you're going to get the Googles and the Facebooks and the leading companies and the 60 who have been involved in your effort. But you're not going to get the edge players. You're not going to get, you know, the 12-year-old writing the app in the basement who has access to tremendous amounts of information. You're going to get the best players, and at the end of the day, there's a huge gap that won't be covered.
Let me ask the audience if you have questions to come up. There's a mic there. We're being televised, so you should be. And while anybody's deciding whether they're brave enough to do it, I'll just filibuster for a second. Oh, come on. Somebody's going to start walking up, I bet. No? Let me make one point, and then you're going to stand up next to the mic, sir. So one thing is we've put up this dichotomy. Maybe there should be legislation which is going to write all of this into law. Maybe it should be self-regulation, which is going to allow, the way Stu would say it, innovation to happen on the Internet. I think part of what we've seen historically, I'll just say this with my professor hat on, is that when there's a lot of legislative and administration and press activity, it creates more of an energy around the self-regulation and shifts where the companies are willing to go. And so there's at least a possibility that activity on the legislative side pushes companies to bring out their better selves on their privacy practices and make more transparency and some of the rest. So why don't we go to questions, please?
I just wanted to agree with that. I think that's actually a very important point, and I think pressure from people like Justin and his organization have moved the ball considerably along those lines.
I agree that too. But then when the pressure goes away, the self-reg goes away too.
Okay. Yes. You identify yourself, please, and then question.
Hi, I'm Adam Thier. I'm from Cadis Center at George Mason University. I'd like to challenge Justin and also get Peter's comments on something that always intrigues me about the debate about privacy, which is the parallels between this and debates about child safety. Peter, you raised some of the issues of children's privacy, but...
I'm pro-children, by the way.
But, you know, there's some interesting parallels in these debates, and it sometimes seems to me that we're not on the same page, or some of these institutions are not on the same page, like CDT. We take children's issues and we look at questions of harm. We haven't had a lot of discussion of what the harm is here in the privacy context, but we hear these amorphous, ambiguous concerns about privacy harms that in the children's context, CDT would cast off as dubious or ambiguous. We also look at the question of universal solutions or silver bullets. CDT hasn't favored those when it comes to children's safety, universal ratings, mandated filters, but here you're favoring do not track. And then third, the question of education versus regulation, or education and empowerment versus regulation. I filed many briefs with my friends at CDT saying the less restrictive means approach in the children's context is private filtering, private controls, private empowerment, parental and child and children's education. And yet when it comes to privacy, we throw that out the window. So what gives? Because to me, it seems like there's a lot of parallels here between these two information control regimes. And let's be clear, that's what they are. We're trying to control information. Why do you want to control in this context but not...
I don't want to control information. I want people to be able to make informed choices. That's the problem right now. Right now, I can't find out how my information is being used online, right? And people don't like that. I mean, we're not arguing there's any great, terrible harm here. We're saying that people's information is being traded and moved around, and they don't have the ability to say no. I mean, if you're browsing online, you can delete all your cookies, sure, but can you delete your browser fingerprints? Do you know how to do that? I don't know how to do that. I don't know who's using browser fingerprinting. There's a company called Blukava who apparently has registered the fingerprints of thousands and thousands of consumers. You can't even find out if they're tracking you. I don't want to say that's illegal. I don't want to say that companies can't trade data about me. I just want them to have to tell you that it's being used and to make choices available to me to make informed and fair market decisions about using that data.
Let me take a try at it, maybe a little bit from a lawyer, law professor perspective. So Adam Thier was saying, there's a CDT and privacy advocates propose a framework legislation on privacy, but have resisted that kind of framework approach on child safety. What gives? That's roughly the question. And in the early days, in the early mid 1990s, Congress was writing laws about child safety. I'm going to exaggerate it. Basically said there's so much yucky stuff and sexual stuff and bad stuff on the internet that we're going to make it safe for kids by regulating a lot of that. The Communications Decency Act is going to regulate a lot of that. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's unconstitutional under the First Amendment. We're not going to have an internet that's designed for 11-year-olds. We're going to have an internet that adults can participate in with the full range of things that adults do. And Congress passed additional laws over time under the First Amendment that got challenged, and the Supreme Court clarified what's okay and what's not okay. The last law was upheld, but the first three, I think, were struck down. So when you're talking about a First Amendment and the Supreme Court and precedent, that's not a legislative preference or policy preference. It's sort of seeing where the court has been on the First Amendment. And so a framework law for child safety that violates the First Amendment is pretty easy to see why CDT and others would be against that. I think you're itching to have a response. Was the itch overwhelming or not? Declan, is too many?
Well, I guess the thing I'd add to that is and there are some overlap, which I think are appropriately pointed out, where you can see a kind of a schism in how this is approached. But I think, yeah, at least in the CDT context, I think some of the other consumer groups may have a different view. But what they, in my mind, in this area have been pushing, and it's probably worth mentioning the current Department of Commerce framework, which I think talks to some of this, is providing the consumer with the ability to make a choice, not actually defining what the choice is. It's not an exact parallel, because I think even that has some criticisms tied to comparing with children's safety. And I think the other area where self-regulation is effective, and maybe to the extent that there should be limits or bills of rights, is there probably are some areas, and I believe advertising and marketing, particularly of non-sensitive data, falls outside of this, where the choice is pretty overwhelming, where society should make the choice, so to speak. You know, I don't think that there's much view that kind of behavioral data should be used for making employment decisions or insurance, you know, types of decisions. I also don't think any of that's happening. I don't think the market would allow it. But
the law, though. I mean, the Fair Credit Reporting Act probably applies to that.
Legal issues. Yeah. Why don't we go to the next question?
Yeah, my name is Andrew Keene. I'm a writer from Silicon Valley. I'm troubled by your very ahistorical view of this. I think it was Peter, you talked about something called Web 2.0. I mean, Web 2.0 died about 3 or 4 years ago. It seems as if you're all a little bit behind the times. Have you heard of Groupon? Have you heard of LinkedIn? Have you heard of Farmville? I mean, we're living in an age of the social revolution. John Doerr just put $250 million into a fund for the social. So I'm certainly on Justin's side, but the idea that the internet in 1999 was the same as it is today is so wrong. It's so profoundly wrong that you're miles behind what's really happening. What's really happening is that Web 2.0 has died. What we have now is the social web. What we have is an obsession with self-revelation on the internet. Now, whether that results necessarily in the need for legislation is obviously a complex issue. But I think it's extremely important for Washington to understand that the internet today, and particularly in 2011, where LinkedIn will probably go public, Groupon will probably go public, we're living at a time of social hysteria on the internet, and that changes everything. And it certainly needs to result in legislators in this town thinking about the internet in a different way from the Internet of 1999 or even of 2005.
You know, I think that's a very good – well, first of all, welcome to Washington. But, we're always at some level behind the curve, although we're aware of every company you mentioned. But I think your point, though, is actually very relevant because the proposals that are coming out right now are very similar in many ways to the proposals of that time. And, you know, I guess you could argue, as I think Justin would, and correct me if I'm wrong, that those proposals are for some fundamental principles that shouldn't matter, the time, the technology, the revolution. Or you could argue, as most of the business community does, is we don't know. I mean, do we know for sure? I mean, do we, you know, we used to talk about PII. Now everything's PII. According to the FTC, anything that could ever be identified with a person is PII. Well, that's everything. So, you know, it begs the question, I think, of, well, what if the Congress is to legislate, should it be a whole new framework based on the different regimes we see?
Well, prepare to be disappointed if you come to D.C. and expect anything better. I spent a decade in D.C., and now I...
With all your 10-year-long friends on the panel next
week. It's true. I apologize. But now I live within a short drive or a slightly longer bike ride of John Doerr's offices on Sand Hill Road. I mean, it is Northern California, and in Woodside and Portola you have a lot of bicyclists. There's D.C. is 2 to 5 years behind the state. The state of the art, and nowadays privacy relinquishment is this business model. It's blippy, it's bright kite, it's loop, it's location disclosing, it's Foursquare, it's Doppler. I mean, this is even discarding or selectively disclosing your medical information. I mean, this is a business model that's being funded, but it's one that doesn't really jive with the Washington regulatory mindset, which is almost, it's coming close to embracing the precautionary principle, which is that, well, let's just ban it unless we can be sure it's not going to cause any harm.
One of the hopes for this panel was to provide some history, which is that at the political level, there was a leveling up of legislative and agency action in the late 90s, and then it leveled down again. And I was trying to suggest that there's a whole set of new technologies, including the companies you said, that where there hasn't been any sorting through and coming to rest in society about which are the ways to go and which are not the ways to go. And that level of uncertainty, I think, is part of what's generating the policy process right now in Washington, the FTC, and Commerce reports. Other questions? We have someone getting up? Are you getting up for a question? Yes.
Hi, Steve DelBianco with NetChoice. And the doubt and uncertainty in the environment Peter just described seems to be what guides Justin's belief that we can solve a lot of that with a multi-stakeholder consensus process where everyone comes to the table with an opportunity to express their views and a mandate to have a consensus. And having spent 10 years working at the ICANN multi-stakeholder process, that is somewhat Pollyannish, because what inevitably will happen with the bills that CDT has embraced is while there's rhetoric of multi-stakeholder, the actual legislative language says the Federal Trade Commission will figure out all the details. And all that the FTC does in multi-stakeholder is enable a bunch of stakeholders to send multiple emails. But the FTC becomes judge and jury determining the details of implementation. They are inherently static and inevitably more prescriptive and regulatory than a multi-stakeholder consensus would come up with. So I ask us not to embrace some Pollyannish view of multi-stakeholderism, but really think about who will make the detailed rules that will end up mattering when it comes to innovating on the web.
I mean, I would disagree with that. I mean, the process that is envisioned both by in the Rush bill and in the Department of Commerce report is very much not the FTC being the one with the pen. They're not the ones who make those decisions at the end of the day. Government sits down and discusses and negotiates with companies to find out clever, flexible, industry-specific rules. At the end of the day, they do have the power to say yes or no. But I think fundamentally it's an improvement over saying the FTC should just write the rules all themselves. Would you disagree with that?
They still have the power to to write the rules.
So they have the power to write the rules under some of the provisions, but there are default provisions under the law that apply to the non-safe harbor participants, right?
And then why don't you explain safe harbor, because we haven't really discussed it.
Okay, right. So there are top-line rules to say, you know, you need opt-in permissions for information sharing. You are subject to the private right of action. In order to get the benefit of getting out of those, then you have to develop your own choice program under the Rush bill and perhaps under the Kerry bill as well. In the Rush bill, there's no involvement whatsoever of the FTC in that process other than just saying yes or no. So if you look at how COPPA has worked, right, there are safe harbor programs and COPPA where you get out of some, you are deemed to be in compliance with COPPA if you participate in a safe harbor program. The FTC says yes or no. They can push back, but they're not the ones writing the rules at the end of the day.
They are. I mean, if the FTC has the ability to say no, they have the ability ultimately to write the rules. I guess my response would be, industry codes of conduct are industry codes of conduct, and multiple input from multiple stakeholders in that debate and dialogue is important. I think you get all kinds of views. I think that's the process we went through with the industry-led code that we've developed. And the piece, I think, to the safe harbor that's particularly valuable is that companies that don't follow their stated assertions can be held. There is recourse against companies not meeting their promises, which does go a long way. But, you know, if you contrast the safe harbor to the European Union with, you know, the current DAA code or the NAI code before it, the safe harbor was primarily ultimately written by the government, but it was in response to a European regulatory structure. Here, we're not in that environment. And so I think you wind up with standards. And the other thing about industry codes, and I think if they're transparent in how they're developed and out in the public, is you do get the input from all of the various stakeholders, and the companies ultimately have to respond in a public way. And that serves as a check, really, on effective codes.
We're going to go to the question in a second, but I want to come back to that, Stu, because one of the criticisms of self-regulation over time is that the self is all the companies in the industry and that consumers and users are not part of that. And so, yes, maybe they might be there's not any right to public comment. There's no requirement of notice and choice the way there are for federal rules. Why should we trust the industry itself to do what's right when the consumers are left out, at least as a formal matter?
Well, I think at the end of the day, the answer to that question is, what do the standards say? And because if the standards weren't palatable, I think we'd be hearing. I mean, one of the interesting things about our code of conduct for the cross-business industry, the primary criticism has been it's taken time to deploy, and it's taken a while, and those are fair criticisms, and there's good reasons for it, but it is being rolled out. We have not, curiously, had much criticism, if any, on the substance, because I think the substance actually is stuff that generally is viewed as favorable, allowing consumers in a simple way to decide for themselves what the right standard is.
Okay. I mean, I would say that there really hasn't been any substance yet to really comment on, right? I mean, you have your information on the About Ads info page, because actually seeing the deployment of how these choices are presented to you, no one's seen it. I mean, no one's really seen it.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, there's a 60-page document released July of 2009 that word for word that people can see and have commented on. The government, others have commented, and there's a new webpage that's live as of November, aboutads.info, where consumers can go and today exercise choice. I think the icon is just starting to be deployed. There were apparently 5 billion deployments of it last month. Now the internet's a big place. I've only seen it once myself, and we're looking. But if we look at the pipeline, I think, you know, 6 months from now, you're likely to see this all over, ubiquitously, and the types of choices will develop from there.
Sir?
Craig Spiesel, Online Trust Alliance. One, thank you guys. Actually, I've provided feedback, or our organization has provided feedback. I think clearly the Digital Advertising Alliance is a great first step. I think pulling people together, I think the education component of it and notice is great. But I like to think about what's ahead next after that. So it's not just the serving of interest-based advertising, which, by the way, I think for record, consumers have a tremendous amount of value that they receive from that. But what about the consumers who just don't want the data collected? Where do we see that going in the future? as a next step? What about the consumers who don't want their data shared?
Sure.
Can you share with some perspectives of where...
Sure. And I'll give you just concretely what we're doing along those lines, and I'm sure others will have some views of where it should be. The notion that kind of all data collection should be precluded, both at some level, if it were widely deployed, is unworkable and won't work for specific sites, just operationally blocking collection. Two, at some level, it's already technically possible and exists. To me, it's for behavioral advertising, for our guidelines, it actually is collection and use for that purposes, so it would apply. But the data in many cases is used for multiple purposes, now and potential future purposes. And my sense is you really, unless data is only being used for limited purposes, in which case you could limit collection, you have to really get into uses. And we are looking, as we had committed to our friends at CDT and to the Federal Trade Commission and others, to get a lot more granular about sensitive information. We wanted to get this part going forward. We want to talk about the applicability. We are going to about the applicability to mobile. And then the other types of areas, I mentioned employment before, insurance eligibility, some of those things which, you know, I think Peter's right. I was about to give my legal answer to, which is it's covered except for when it's not covered. You know, in some instances it is, in some instances it isn't, but we can easily solve that because there isn't anybody who's participating in the program or any legitimate businesses that I know of that want to use that type of data for employment eligibility type purposes. So a lot more coming along those lines, but it isn't going to go, I think, to you know, where you could read at least some suggestion of the Federal Trade Commission report to say all collection, period. It's just not workable.
Let's. We've got about 4 minutes. I'm going to ask to go down the row if there's one or two points, and perhaps connected to our theme about legislation versus self-regulation or other points about privacy you'd like to bring up at the end. Stu.
I think if the codes of conduct that the Department of Commerce called for, that the FTC, I think, have encouraged and are very much supportive of, I think if they can continue to grow and get widespread support of the business community and participation by consumers, the legislative debate at some level really becomes less important. Maybe you get legislation that allows for those continued practices, maybe you don't. If that doesn't get more widely deployed and accepted, I think you wind up right in the middle of the 12-year debate we've been having, and it'll continue, and maybe at some point there will be a law that hurts innovation.
I guess my main point would be, you know, to think just whether privacy has gotten better or worse over the last 15 years. And anyone who's been following the Wall Street Journal series of articles on what they know, I mean, I think you recognize that you've seen like a just tremendous increase in the ability of tracking and following consumers on the internet just in the last several years. So 5 years ago, maybe dictionary.com couldn't drop 50 cookies or 250 separate trackers on your computer when you went there, but now they can. Before, an analytics company couldn't ask whether you've been to 100, 300 different sites when you go to a page, so they can sniff your browser history to see if you've been there or not. You know, 10 years ago, DoubleClick got in trouble for buying a company with the view towards eventually linking online and offline identities. Now there are companies like Rapleaf and Datalogix, whose entire business model is linking offline data to online cookies and behavioral advertising. So I think this empirically, privacy is getting a lot worse for consumers. Self-regulation, by and large, has not done it. We think there really needs to be just really basic, straightforward, smart protections to let consumers know what's going on and allow them to make informed choices.
Two points. The first is I'm still looking for this rigorous economic analysis of what privacy legislation could or couldn't do. I mean, just because you don't like the outcome doesn't mean there's a market failure. Just because there's imperfect information doesn't mean there's a market failure. I had dinner last week with Robin Hanson from George Mason, an economist there, and he said, you know, a lot of things that are described as market failures I'll fail my students on. Economists have a rigorous definition. Second point is, imagine, as an analogy, there's a hypothetical National Center for Women and Children and Family Values, and they say that media organizations are airing too much sexually explicit material. It's page 3, girl pinups. And if you apply congressional pressure and threaten a new law, you might get a reduction in these page 3 girls and new behinds on NYPD Blue. But if media attention shifts somewhere else, those naked rears may reappear, so we can't trust media companies, so we need the FTC to regulate this, we need the FTC to ban them preemptively. Just think of that as an analogy. analogy.
Well, I had no idea Naked Behinds were going to be part of the wrap-up, but we're in a new round of trying to figure out a lot of technologies that are different from 10 years ago, and I think the people in this room will have a role in trying to figure out what the good practices are for consumers and for the companies. In terms of logistics, there will be a new panel in here at 3:30. There's coffee on the outside, and let's thank our panel for their participation here.